This morning I have for you, remember I said at my first lecture, I want to talk about continuity of one particular story and creativity with respect to how that story gets told today. And I have five sermon bits, or in some cases, in the case of short sermons, you see the whole thing or hear it. Five different ways into this story, inviting people into this biblical story without, I hope, boring them. And I want to give you those five ways, and then we'll look at samples of each one. Speaking from inside the story, speaking from within the story, I don't like this one usually because it's not always very believable. My cardinal example of a time when it didn't work very well for me was on the Annunciation, when my 45-year-old bearded pastor came out in his alb and stole and said, "I'm Mary." And then proceeded to do a first-person narrative on being Mary and having the angel visit you, you know, and you're just thinking, I'm trying to work with you here, but it's not happening for me. In this sermon, I'm going to show you Fred Geiser, one of my Old Testament colleagues at Luther Seminary, actually speaks in the first person from God's point of view, which after, you know, and it's also a rhetorical phenomenon for another reason that you'll catch right away. It's an example of speaking your sermon from what, you know, you inhabit some part of the story and you speak from that as you preach. Speaking from a parallel universe, I use a poem from Wendell Berry called The Birth Near Port William. I don't know if anyone knows this poem. He said he wrote it in like 68, I think. I heard it in 98 on Christmas Eve of 1998. He read it on All Things Considered. And I tried in vain last week to get the streaming audio for you onto a disc so I wouldn't have to be hooked up to the internet to get the audio of Wendell Berry reading his own poem, and it just didn't happen. I didn't have the right IT people. I didn't have any IT people. let's be clear, it's not our staff. I just didn't get it, but I've got the poem, and I'll read it to you. It is about these two pieces. Each one of them is 5 or 6 minutes long. Fred's might be a little bit longer than that. Speaking then and now, and this is probably what we do best, most of us, what our kind of default setting is. And sometimes it feels like you're in that rowboat between the first century and the 21st, and you're traversing this long distance, and you resort to analogies that maybe work or don't work so well. Lisher's sermon on the story of the man born blind works pretty well as he starts to talk about what has happened to this young man and what may be happening in the congregation to which he preaches. He teaches homiletics at Duke Divinity School, and Paul Palumbo and I both worked with him there. I've got two samples of his material. I probably won't use the whole sermon acknowledgement, but I'll use a piece of it. He's also ELCA Lutheran, trained in the Missouri Synod system, and was a Missouri Synod pastor at the start of his ministry. Speaking into the story, this is the opposite from speaking, from standing inside the story and speaking out. This is standing where you stand, wherever you are, whether, you know, as a sort of observer, and talking to one of the characters. And I've done this twice in sermons, and if we get this far, or if I decide not to skip Dear Canaanite Sister, you'll hear two of them, because I'm going to do this evening in the sermon that is prepared for the evening Eucharist. In my estimation, hearing two of these in one day is at least one too many. I'm like the Pharisees, right? Do what they say, don't do what they do. This can get old, and when I was a child, our pastor loved the gospel according to Peanuts, Anybody remember this book or whatever? And so he was always quoting this, and my parents didn't understand. I think they didn't understand that it was a book and that it was actually on some level sort of contemporary theology. And they thought he got up in the morning on Sunday, read Peanuts, and came to church. And that was the extent of his sermon preparation. They were really annoyed by that. At least that's what I remember them thinking at when I was 6 years old. That anything you do like this can, you know, get too cute. And one of the things we might want to talk about as a group is, you know, at what point are you, is your form overtaking your content? So people are paying much more attention to what you're doing than what you're saying in preaching. And then speaking ahead of time, and I don't know if Dick is in here, but gosh, there's a couple of pieces that connect with the sermon from Matins this morning. And I picked this as well because I want to say, remember I said we're in this narrative, right? Or we want to continue to, we want to draw people into this narrative. But the thing about our narrative, our Christian narrative, is it's not done yet. We have an end to this story. We have visions of it, like in Revelation and other places. He will wipe away every tear. But we're still very much in the middle of it. Without having to imagine ourselves in Palestine, we can imagine ourselves in the middle of this story. And Lisher takes our position in the middle of the story, and in this case, at a time when a Duke University student has just died, and the following Sunday he's scheduled to preach at Duke Chapel, and he takes that place in the middle of the story and talks about the end of the story. So speaking ahead of time. Barry's poem has a line in it about a character who could trust in the future or imagine the future. He could imagine tomorrow before it became today. That's what I mean by speaking ahead of time. Questions on the way I outlined this? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Repeatedly, and then adding certain things to the front of it, like meta. I'm aware of how it's used. I wonder if you could translate it for me.
The comment is, we're all saying narrative. What do we mean? I mean a story, and I'm trying to remember E.M. Forster's aspects of the novel. In that book, he says, which, is anybody going to be able to help me with this? And they're like, okay, bigger than a bread box? Plot gives you not just events, but also reasons for the events. So a story might be just sort of quote unquote reporting the news. This happened and then this happened. The king died and the queen died is a story. This is Forster's example. The king died and the queen died of grief is a plot. Now, so when I say narrative, I want story, but I want a little bit more than story. I want story with plot line, which will be something besides one damn thing after another, if you'll pardon me, but actually a kind of flow, so that the end, especially in the Christian story, the end influences the middle. Because I know let me get there from here. Wait a minute. I think one of the things that Jesus does is kind of pull the end of the story into the present. So Martha says, Jesus says to Martha, your brother will rise on the last day, right? The end of the story. And Martha's like, that wasn't bothering me. You know, I know my brother will rise on the last day. Your brother will rise again. I know my brother will rise on the last day. And Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. And by his raising of Lazarus kind of pulls the future into the present, pulls the end of the story into the middle. I want beginning, middle, and end and to have relationship to each other. And that's what I mean by narrative. Maybe the other speakers will say more about what they're talking about. I don't see any of them here. I didn't call on them. And story doesn't work for you if it's something else?
It matters what works for you. But yeah. If you keep saying narrative over and over again, then packages it in such a way that I'm not able to follow what you're really wanting to say. It becomes jargon.
Huh. Okay. Well, something narrated, something told. I think meta-narrative means there's a kind of overarching story, then most of the time we're not even aware that we're sort of living in that. Like, my mom just died, as Bob told you, this spring, and mother would tell lots of stories about lots of times in her life, work life, depression, losing the Great Depression, losing her dad when she was 11 years old and all this sort of thing. But every story had this kind of theme in it, which was, I was met with great adversity, and I overcame it. And that was her. That was what I would call her meta-narrative. So she had a big story, and then all the little stories kept telling the same big story. I think that's what Mike is up to with meta-narrative. Other stuff? Ready to look at Fred's piece? Now, this is a video that I got off the web from the Luther Seminary Chapel archives. As such, it's going to be heavily pixelated while he's moving. He doesn't move a lot in the sermon, but you know, you'll see the little dots or the little squares. So we'll just all, I mean, if we can wash our hands in cold water for 3 days, we can watch this video. It's Luther Seminary Chapel a while ago now, 10-10-2002, I think. And he'll read the text for you. See if I can get it bigger. And it gets better than that.
A reading from Isaiah chapter 5. Let me sing for my beloved my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. He expected it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, inhabitants of Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it? When I expected it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and it shall be overgrown with briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are his pleasant planting. He expected justice, but saw bloodshed, righteousness, but heard a cry. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. a love song for the vineyard. The word of the Lord. It's a love song I'd sing, and salvation I'd bring to my people, beloved and strong. But can't do what I would, for I made them for good, and somehow they got it all wrong. Home, home, please come home. There's death where you've chosen to roam. I stand and I knock. Can't you hear the dread clock ticking tock? Tick tock, tick tock, tick tock. They were meant to bear fruit, but they pillage and loot. They're a vineyard that's grown old and wild. So I'll prune and I'll cut, and the door I will shut to my dwelling, though they are my child. Let me set forth my case, lest you think that my face just turns this way and that way for sport. No. Redeemer's my name, steadfast love is my game. I seek life. I am not Voldemort. So I planted and tilled, all their enemies killed. Not so nice, I confess, but deserved. I gave them a land, their expansion I planned, and their lives above all I preserved. Did I act out of greed? Is there something I need for myself? Not one thing. I am God. Well, maybe their love. Or as I watched from above, some concern for the earth. Not so odd. But they squabbled and fought, did not love as they ought. They could have done well if they would. I expected a crop. What I got was a flop. And a cow's would have smelled just as good. So I'll plow up their land. I will decrease their yield. What was fertile will now become rocks. I will lay their land waste. I will do it in haste. Habitat for just jackal and fox. I can sense your surprise. You thought I was one of those guys who would never turn out to be judge. But for judges there's place midst this sad human race. For no justice, no judges, no justice, no nudge. And should you complain, death is more of a pain than a nudge. It's more like a knife. Let me hasten to say, death is with you to stay. I just want even it to serve life. So home, home, please come home. There's death where you've chosen to roam. I stand and I knock. Can't you hear the dread clock ticking tock, tick tock, tick tock, tick tock? Now, lest you think, wow, that was then, this is now, I'm sure glad that that testament's old. I want to make clear that you are so dear to me, I'll judge you too. You've been told. You have heard me sing them, perhaps thinking, ah, man, they just got their desserts after all. But I'll give you a clue. You must substitute you, for now you are the people I call. If you think they had a land that was pleasant and grand, look around and see what you've been given. Wealth like yours is unknown. Fat and lazy you've grown. You're quite sure that you're worthy of heaven. So I sing you my song for you to get it wrong. Your priority's quite out of whack. It's not plowshares but swords that get greatest rewards. And tight ends take home gold by the sack. But not me, you retort. I'm not one of that sort with embarrassing wealth out the ears. But have you one suit and another to boot? Then the Mount Sermon should bring you tears. You need never say no to a glass of Merlot when you put fine perfumes in your bath. Lay up treasures on earth, but they'll only give birth to a harvest of dark grapes of wrath. So what should I do? Send my son down to you, but would he not suffer the fate of all others who dare to suggest you should care for the beggars who stand at the gate? They're there, don't you see? More in them, please see me, standing, knocking, and waiting for bread. While you play and you pray in your nonchalant way, doing little to see that they're fed. But I've plighted my troth to come there where the moth and the rust have their way with all things. They will have at me too when I enter your stew. But I love you. Ride home on my wings. It's a love song I'd sing, and salvation I'd bring. I will never give up my refrain, for it's life that I seek for the strong and the meek. Won't you please come in out of the rain? Home, home, please come home. There's death where you've chosen to roam. I stand and I knock. Can't you hear that dread clock? Ticking tock, ticking tock, tick, tick, tock.
Sitting down. That's the best example I know of lately, anyway, of somebody speaking from within the story and managing not to just be annoying as all get out. And one of the reasons it works for Fred is that he teaches Isaiah and he just spends a lot of time in that text. And so all that stuff about jackal and fox and things, that's all, he's alluding to scripture as he does that. I also like it because I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to preach from the Old Testament and tell this particular story that I'm so invested in. And I thought he pulled together Old and New Testaments nicely in the piece. Some of you may have been put off by the tune, but it works for me. I don't know if it's one of those too cute things or not. Can I get lights again? Because we're not gonna do more film. Here's the Wendell Berry piece. It's set in a barn. People are lambing. Last night, somebody said, a young person said, he understood two genres of all the films, and it was the music video and something else, and The Passion, because he'd seen that. But otherwise, all these Jesus films were completely foreign to him. And so I looked at this morning and thought, well, if you've never been in a barn, this may not work for you. But part of the great fun of reading, you know, knowing how to read, is that you can get transported to. They were into the lambing up late, talking and smoking around their lantern. They squatted in the barn door left open, so the quiet of the winter night diminished what they said. The chill had begun to sink into their clothes. Now and then they raised their hands to breathe on them. The youngest one yawned and shivered. "Damn," he said, "I'd like to be asleep. I'd like to be curled up in a warm nest like an old groundhog and sleep till spring." "When I was your age, Billy, it wasn't sleep I thought about," Uncle Stanley said. "Last few years I've took to sleeping." And Raymond said, "To sleep till spring? You'd have to have a trust in things the way animals do. Been a long time, I reckon, since people felt safe enough to sleep more than a night. You might wake up someplace you didn't go to sleep at." They hushed a while, as if to let the dark brood on what they had said. Behind them, a sheep stirred in the bedding and coughed. It was getting close to midnight. Later, they would move back along the row of penned ewes, making sure the newborn lambs were well dried and had sucked, and then they would go home cold to bed. The barn stood between the ridgetop and the woods along the bluff. Below was the valley floor and the river they could not see. They could hear the wind dragging its underside through the bare branches of the woods. And suddenly the wind began to carry a low singing. They looked across the lantern at each other's eyes and saw they all had heard. They stood, their huge shadows rising up around them. The night had changed. They were already on their way, dry leaves underfoot and mud under the leaves, to another barn, on down along the wood's edge, an old stripping room, where by the light of the open stove door they saw the man and the woman. They saw the man and then the woman and the child lying on a bed of straw on the dirt floor. "Well, look a there," the old man said. "First time this ever happened here." And Billy, looking and looking away, said, "Howdy, howdy. Bad night." And Raymond said, "There's a first time, they say, for everything." And that, he thought, was as reassuring as anything was likely to be and as he needed it to be. They did what they could, not much. They brought a piece of rug and some sacks to ease the hard bed a little, and one red wedged $3 bills into a crack in the wall in a noticeable place. And they stayed on, looking away, until finally the man said they were well enough off and should be left alone. They went back to their sheep. For a while longer, they squatted by their lantern and talked, tired, wanting sleep, yet stirred by wonder. Old Stanley, too, though he would not say so. "Don't make no difference," he said. "They'll have them anywhere. Looks like a man would have the right to be born in bed, if not die there, but he don't." "But you heard that singing in the wind," Billy said. "What about that?" "Ghosts. They do that way." "Not that way." "Scared him, it did," the old man laughed. "We'll have to hold his damn hand for him and lead him home." "It don't even bother you," Billy said. "You'd go right on just the same. But you heard." "Now that I'm old, I sleep in the dark. That ain't what I used to do in it. I heard something." "You heard a good deal more than you'll understand," Raymond said, "or him or me either." They looked at him. He had, they knew, a talent for unreasonable belief. He could believe in tomorrow before it became today, a human enough failing, and they were tolerant. He said, "It's the old ground, trying it again, solstice, seeding, and birth that never gets enough. It wants the birth of a man to bring together sky and earth, like a stalk of corn. It's not death that makes the dead rise out of the ground, but something alive, straining up, rooted in darkness like a vine. That's what you heard. If you're in the right mind when it happens, it can come on you strong. You might hear music passing on the wind or see a light where there wasn't one before. Well, how do you know if it amounts to anything? You don't. It usually don't. It would take a long, long time to ever know. But that night and other nights afterwards, up late, there was a feeling in them, familiar to them, but always startling in its strength, like the thought on a winter night of the lambing ewes dry-bedded and fed, and the thought of the wild creatures warm, asleep in their nests, deep underground. I have never used this in a public setting. I think you could. I think it tells a story of, I think the end is, you know, is the eschatology. There's this, things are right. The lambs have a warm place to sleep, and the creatures are trusting enough to fall asleep and not worry so much about where they're going to wake up. We might ask, if we were having a discussion on that piece, Wendell Berry piece, how much do you have to know for that to work for you as a Jesus story? And probably quite a bit. I mean, this is probably not the only thing you say to somebody. But when you know the Jesus story, there's a kind of intertextuality thing going on in your head as you hear it. Speaking then and now, I said this is sort of what we do as preachers, maybe more often than anything else. Am I standing in a bad place, Matt, or is it just going to feed back a little? Or a little tinny? Okay. This is like not marking the text before you get up to read, and then you can't find it. The text for this sermon is the story of the man born blind. And Lisher begins by saying, Jesus is adhering to an ancient and mysterious standard of care when he mixes dust and spit into a sticky paste. He places it on the man's eyelids and kneads the man's eyes. He anointed them, the text said. And so on. He tells this story and then talks about what it's like. He focuses on the fact that the man gets interrogated, basically, right after his conversion, and Jesus is missing, so he can't really say, over to you. And he has to try to make his confession, and it's not clear that he knows a whole lot about the fine points of messianic expectation or the way Jesus is fulfilling it, but he does have something to say. Let's see. Now, in our story, we have the ancient version, not of who's on first, but where's he from? The authorities, desperate now, sink to the oldest of all debate tactics. Assail the source of your opponent's argument. Poison the well. Where's this guy Jesus from? What rabbinical school did he attend? Where did he learn to break God's law by doing cures on the Sabbath? We would like to see this professor's CV. The formerly blind man replies, where's he from? Why, this man restored my sight. Never since the world began has a man blind from birth received his sight. And you want to know where he's from? Things have gotten out of hand by this time because the blind man is experiencing the freedom and joy of one who sees not from a human perspective, but from God's perspective. Does the story mean you have to have special knowledge to be a Christian? Must you see the way God sees? No, not knowledge, but acknowledgement. The formerly blind man did not know all the correct religious phrases with which to interpret his salvation. He was not even pious in a religious sense or even respectful of his elders. What he knew for sure was that once upon a time he sat in the darkness and the dust, waiting to die, and now the whole world was drenched in sunlight. And he acknowledged that. "One thing I know," he might have said, "I don't have all that churchy jargon about Jesus down pat like some of these preachers have it. I may never speak in well-rounded certitude about God and the meaning of life, and I may be a little rough around the edges when it comes to relating to my elders. But one thing I do know." And as he makes his witness to us, we realize that the man blind from birth has a multitude of sons and daughters, each with their own story to tell. "One thing I know," one of you might say, Duke University Chapel, remember, "is that back in September, when I was 1,000 miles from home and drowning in loneliness and more work than I'd imagined, somehow I got through that. And I think that somehow was God." Or another of you might say, "One thing I know is that when I was going through my divorce, I hurt so much I couldn't sleep or eat and was so filled with hate I couldn't think. But somehow I passed through that. And I've come to recognize that somehow was God." "One thing I know," another of you might say, "was that I was getting blind every weekend, and my weekends began on Tuesday. Such a big man I was. But one day I looked in the mirror and really saw myself for what I was. Only now have I come to recognize that that loser in the mirror was really Jesus calling me to something better. One thing I know." Isn't that a marvelous understatement? As if the only teensy thing you know is who saved your life. That's the, it goes on, but again, he's made some decisions about who to include, how to tell a story, but I think he's trying to tell a common story with these, we might say, subplots or sub-narratives. acknowledgement. You don't have it all together, you know something. You know, the one teensy little thing you happen to know is who saved your life. Speaking into the story. I have time to do this. Good. Three years ago now, Paul Palumbo, we were at Collegeville, Minnesota, the Ecumenical Institute there. Collegeville is the home of St. John's Abbey and University. It's the largest Benedictine monastery in the world. They run a university. And their ecumenical institute is connected, but not completely under the auspices of St. John's. The ecumenical institute, in coordination with the Abbey's work on a new manuscript, have you heard about this, the new Bible? Seen it. In connection with that, they put together an ecumenical consultation called Igniting Biblical Imagination. And Paul and I got to be part of it, or were part of it for... him, Paul for one summer, me for two, week-long periods of time. There was a dancer, there were poets, there were lots of visual artists involved, about 25 people, probably altogether 20 people, a Jewish catechist from the Twin Cities. One of the people there teaches creative writing at the University of Minnesota, and one evening, we were just kind of, it was a hard first week. I got the good week, which was the second year, and Paul gave up on it too soon. We just couldn't get any traction at all. You know, everybody's kind of wandering around in the aesthetic of Scripture, and God forbid we should actually read the Bible and, you know, and meet a God who's going to destroy a vineyard or something, you know, that and talk about what that means. So we were all kind of in the pastel ether for quite a while. And one of the helpful things that somebody did in the midst of that was say to us, "I'm going to give you an assignment," you know, the professor of creative writing. "I want you to go home tonight before we have another session tomorrow and write a letter to somebody. It can be a letter to somebody that's going to, you know, be baptized. A letter to somebody," he said, who maybe is going off to college and will be taking a religion class. A letter to something about the Bible, a letter to somebody about the Bible, or he said, you can write to somebody in the Bible. So God, what were you thinking when you set out to, you know, tear up your own vineyard? What was going through your mind? Something like that, right? Write a letter. And I have since stolen the assignment and given it in a couple of different places. And it's just great. It's like one of those assignments that you hate to think about doing, but it works when you do it. Like, you know, don't lift up your pen for 10 minutes. And it's a discipline. It starts out as a discipline, and it ends up being something that's quite revealing. This is a version of the letter I wrote. I teach the Gospel of Matthew, as you know. In Matthew, the woman that comes to Jesus in Tyre and Sidon and asks that her daughter be healed is called a Canaanite, not a Syrophoenician woman, but the old language of the people who were in the promised land before God, through Joshua and others, basically committed genocide and got rid of them. Not to put too fine a point on it. I mean, you know, Golda Meir half a century ago said, you don't take land without some bloodshed. Or, you know, I mean, that, and welcome to Joshua. In the New Testament, we get this Canaanite showing up, needing something from Jesus. That's weirder than the Samaritan woman talking to him. And so I talk a little bit to her. I don't think I need to set it up anymore. It's pretty short. Dear Canaanite sister, you go, girl. I've never seen anyone talk to Jesus like that. And this from someone who so clearly does not belong. No one has called anyone a Canaanite for centuries. You are a foreigner, or you would be a foreigner if it were not your home turf that Jesus had wandered into. What's more, you are a Canaanite woman in the middle of a group of Jewish men. You are so out of place and out of time, and so exactly where your daughter needs you to be. I heard you first before I saw you. You were screaming, crying out, crying, wailing in that emergency room that doubles as a road through Tyre and Sidon. So completely foreign it all was. What were you doing there? What was Jesus doing there? You would tell him what he was doing. Have mercy on me, son of David, you said. My daughter is tormented by a demon. You were screaming when you said this, hysterical, we would say. It was hard to hear, harder to watch. You followed those men, still crying after them. The disciples wondered if the demon didn't have hold of you too. You kept shouting. They asked Jesus to dismiss you. He ignored them. But he ignored you too, and some of us who know him found this silence even more disturbing than your cries. Then he spoke, and things got worse. I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, he said. At that point, had I been you, I would have gotten angry. Sent only to Israel, huh? Then what the hell are you doing in Tyre? Need a map, Mr. Omniscient Son of God? Did you teach the teacher? Lord, help me, you said, instead of fussing about who was lost and who was out of place. To which you heard, it is not fair to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. You were kneeling when he said this to you, existing low, where it is possible to smell exactly what the Rottweiler had for lunch. Had you fallen at his feet just to stop him in his tracks? Maybe, but your kneeling looked like the posture of worship, too. It looked like you were praying when he said you were a dog, and heaven knows, Lord, help me, is a prayer. It is not fair to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. We still cannot quite believe our Jesus said this. We are so embarrassed that Jesus would call anyone a dog. And we are so nonchalant about God keeping promises to God's children to feed them. Unless, of course, we are the children of God to whom the promises were made. But when Jesus spoke of the children and their bread, he was not talking about most of us any more than he was talking about you. You knelt before him, And he said as much, and he as much as said to you, you are right where you belong, dog. I wonder if it was not your place below the action that told you what to say next. Yes, Lord. Yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. I'm down here, Lord, with the dogs, looking for just a little. My daughter, have mercy. Crumbs. Did you teach the teacher? I think you did. Because of you and your fierce need, God's own son himself came to see his life's work as bigger than before. What he had not thought to look for in anyone like you, he saw faith. He saw your tenacious conviction that he could help, and amazed, he did. I have thought that fear makes it impossible to imagine things. Perfect fear casts out all imagination, I have thought. But you were afraid. You must have been afraid of the demon and of your daughter's suffering and afraid of all those foreign men and all their insults. You must have been afraid. Yet you could see a new thing, healing, at the same time. Woman, Jesus said, choosing, finally, a better name than dog. Great is your faith. You imagined healing before it happened, and you showed it to the healer. Walking by faith, crying out by faith, kneeling and talking back to God by faith like that, what might we see? Can faith declare God's work for us in places where we don't belong? Will faith point us with you to that stranger on the road, out of place himself, who certainly can help? Will it break for us the loaf that is enough for children and for dogs? Might your story help us grasp these things even when we're terrified? You taught the teacher. What will you teach us? That's the letter. What did I call that? Speaking into the story. I'm much more comfortable with this, because then I can have my voice and not you know, come out and say, I'm the Canaanite woman and my daughter was really sick. As soon as somebody does that, I think you're not going to be faithful enough to the scriptures to work for me to be able to work with you. Some of you may do lots better than I do at attempting that kind of work. This is the opposite kind of thing. Last piece. Then we can visit about this some if you want. This is the sermon on an Advent Sunday after. Here's what happened to this young woman. And Paul, you will probably remember this. 1992, she was riding on a full bus. Isn't this the freshman at Duke University riding on one of the buses? There's a 2 mile or so walk between, or you know, road between the East Campus and the West Campus. That's what they call them. Right? It's funny how you leave a place and you can't remember those things. And she was riding on a bus and she fell out of the bus and was run over and killed. I mean, it was just a bus. It was a carting kids back and forth between the campuses, and you know how they get full and people stand up, and there was jostling or it turned or something, and she just tumbled out the side door. And I remember talking to Rick about this and saying, you know, of all the things I can imagine worrying about when my 18-year-old goes to college, I do not worry about her falling out of the campus bus. The campus was just kind of freaked out by this. And Lisher is up to preach the following Sunday. He's got a couple of texts that came right out of the lectionary that day. And I don't know if Dick's here, but Lisher's going to talk about hate in his sermon, and this one's going out to Dick after this morning's matins. These are the words of the prophet Malachi, the last four verses of the Old Testament. For behold, the day comes, burning like an oven, when all the arrogant and all evildoers will be stubble. The day comes, the day that comes shall burn them up, says the Lord of hosts. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. And these are the words of John, the apocalyptic seer. Behold, he comes with clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also who pierced him, and all the kindred of the earth shall wail because of him. Even so, amen. I, John, who am your brother and companion in tribulation, I saw these things. Behold, a door opened in heaven, and the first voice I heard was a trumpet talking, which said, come up hither, alleluia, and I will show you things which must be hereafter. And I heard a great voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling of God is with people. God will be with them. God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no death, neither sorrow nor crying, and there shall be no night, for the Lamb is the light thereof. Alleluia, amen. Each in his own way, the prophet and the seer speaks words that we desperately need to take into our hearts. Each says, I have seen the future, and it belongs to God. With Advent exactly 2 weeks away, the whole Christian church on earth imperceptibly begins to lean forward and to yearn for the coming of God. Our lessons reflect that. The lessons read today are not specifically chosen for Duke Chapel. They represent the church's rhythm of faith. For many here today, that yearning for God has a greater revelation, and a greater revelation is focused by the death of Amy Elizabeth Geisinger, a member of this choir and a sister in the body of Jesus Christ. It is good that we have these lessons so the whole church can minister to us. It is good that we have dancers and drums today, because much of what we feel cannot be spoken, but only danced and furiously drummed. What words we sing will stick in our throats. What words we speak will be nothing more than a groan of faith in the God who is Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. God will come, so say the prophet and the seer, not as a baby anymore, but God will come in a quite different way to set all things right. In the meantime, we dance and drum, sing and weep, not only because a precious 18-year-old has died, but because after the dying and the crying comes God. Most people think of God as occupying more of the past than the future. God seems to fit right in museums and temple friezes, ancient manuscripts, the old masters. That's God's element. Even personally, when we think of God, don't our minds, this is an interesting Christendom image from Rick, don't our minds dart back to childhood when those Bible stories and Sunday school lessons created a world in which we had a place? O God of my youth, the poet prayed, when you think about your time in this university, isn't it more comfortable to think about all the familiar people and events that brought you to this place than it is to contemplate the riddle of what awaits you as you leave? The past has a face, the future, and today we must say death, is without form or face. But precisely here, where life is hardest and most inscrutable, Christianity speaks a word into the void. It proclaims a future that has contours and form and even a face. The God of the Bible, who is in the New Testament known as the Father of Jesus, is a God of the future. The past, for all its vastness, isn't a big enough place for all that God promises to be, for Amy and for all who've preceded us in death. And for us too, he might have said. Only God is capable of caring for the past and the future. He goes on to tell a story of a little boy dying when he was in elementary school, and Rick couldn't eat or sleep for days, and he didn't know the child that well, but it affected him deeply. And then he says, a few days ago, my mind went back to that event, and I was shocked to realize that I couldn't remember the boy's name. That's the fear, isn't it? When we're old and gray, who will remember Amy Elizabeth's name and cherish her as a person? Who will remember me? When we're all gone, who will remember us? When it comes to remembering, we are not accomplished, but God is. God said to Israel through the prophet Isaiah, "Can a mother forget her nursing child? Even these may forget, but I will not forget you." Here's the piece on Malachi and the seer paint two very different scenarios for the future, but each with the same lead actor, God. Malachi, the unknown prophet, was ministering to a depressed people now returned from exile. Israel as a nation state was gone. The temple was nothing. Because they had no future, they were hurting and hurting one another. Malachi tells us something we didn't know about God or had repressed. The Old Testament doesn't end with a beatific vision, but with a burst of rage. "For behold, the day of the Lord comes burning like an oven, when all the arrogant and all evildoers will be stubble. The day that comes shall burn them up," says the Lord of hosts. As it turns out, the God of the future is not the benign presence we'd imagined, but a God who takes sides and says, "I'm fed up with suffering and hunger, two-bit tyrants and evildoers. I will have my day." In the prophet's own words, this is a God who is capable of uttering the sentence, "I hate. I hate evil in all its forms." Someone has said, if you love the good but don't hate evil, you are doomed to sentimentality. But a God who hates? When our son was a very little guy, one of our family projects was to train him not to say hate. We had nice little talks about it. "That's an emotion, and those are words that are not worthy of you," we said. And by the way, that's an argument that doesn't work particularly well with a four-year-old. "You didn't learn to say hate in Sunday school," we said, "not from Jesus." We never let him read Malachi. "Jacob have I loved, Esau I have hated." Or Amos, "I hate, I despise your feasts." Or Isaiah, "I hate robbery and wrong." Or even the psalmist, "The Lord loves those who hate evil." We're tempted to say to God, "This is an emotion, and these are words that are unworthy of you." But Malachi says there are some things that are worthy of God's rage and ours. If you can visit the concentration camp in Dachau and walk through the wrought iron gate through which thousands of prisoners passed, and if you can run your hands over the terrible lie that is carved into wrought iron, "Arbeit macht frei," work will make you free, and not feel rage, then listen again to Malachi's God. Or if you can open the newspaper and see the aged faces on the bodies of children in Somalia without feeling rage, not only at the governments of the world who can deliver bombs on time but not food, but rage that God's precious creatures are being wasted, then listen again to the prophet's God. When a young woman is lost for no reason at all, you can almost hear Malachi's God say, "I hate that my dear child has died." The Gospel of Mark tells us that one day Jesus was confronted by a precious creature covered with sores and putrid flesh who cried out, "Jesus, make me clean." Here, what scholars take as the original wording of his reply is very mysterious. It says, "Jesus, moved with rage, touched him." No one knows the meaning of that reaction, but we might understand that as God's own anger. But might we understand that as God's own anger at the suffering of a good creation? And what of John the Seer's scenario? So he's done Malachi now. From the apocalypse, we learn something more about God. We learn that God heals wounds and wants to minister to us forever. "I have seen the future," says John, "and death and suffering and weeping will have no part in it." The God of Malachi cuts through evil like a blowtorch. Malachi's God rages with us. We turn to Revelation and we see the saints gathered around the throne, and there, high and lifted up, receiving the praises of all who have died, is Jesus Christ, not the angry warrior or general we might have expected, but the Lamb. The Lamb is in the midst of them. What does this vision mean to us at this moment of our lives? A great philosopher once said there are only three questions worth asking: who made the world, what ought I to do, and what may I hope? Today, the third question is on our minds. Both Malachi and John the Seer say, you may hope in God. The same God who thundered over Palestine is the father of Jesus, who watched his son go to the cross in solidarity with all who suffer and must die. He is the Lamb who was slain. We may hope in the God who raised Jesus from death. Jesus was like Israel, lost and without a future, like our sister in Christ, gone before her time. Jesus was like us in our own worst days of sorrow. God made him alive. Why? That we might live in hope. The resurrection of Jesus is a promise. It doesn't solve all problems. It is a God-given signal that the slaughter, the starving, our sister, and all people who seem to be slipping away from us are not meant to be discarded or forgotten, and will not be. It is a sign that they and we are meant to be more, not less than we are. That even death, as authoritative and final as it seems, is not the last word. The resurrection is a pillar of fire ahead of the whole human race. It is a testimony, not only to the depth of human hoping, but to the reality of God in Jesus Christ. If you want to know where God stands on issues of suffering and death, if you want to know what God thinks when he sees you walking away from a cemetery, if you want to know what God feels when God sees your tears, then go to the cross and the tomb of God's Son and listen for testimony. I have seen the future, says Jesus. It is as cold and hard as a tomb and as glorious as the saints in heaven. Anyone can say it, dear brothers and sisters. You don't have to be a prophet or a preacher, but only a man or woman of faith. I have seen the future, and its name is Jesus. That's Lisher, kind of a funeral sermon, kind of an Advent sermon. I used it because he's working with the end and connecting it to Jesus. Jesus' resurrection is the pillar of fire that goes before the people. That's where we're headed. We have very few minutes, but do you want to talk back? Hasn't happened in this Lens conference. Speaker's not leaving enough time. Oh, thank you. Fan club letter. Fan mail. Yeah, thanks. Try it. Yeah, you know, try this at home. The letter thing. You'll hear things in the text you haven't heard before. Yeah.
I just have kind of a simple question regarding delivery of style. I'm in the habit in my preaching of asking questions of the congregation, utilizing questions to sort of challenge them or direct their thinking. Someone told me once that in preaching you should never ask a question you haven't answered.
The comment here is that Mark asks questions in the sermons. Rhetorical questions, or you wait for people to answer?
A little bit of both answers.
Sometimes both. Paul, have you done that? Ask questions in sermons and people will answer you. Paul was my pastor for 5 years, so this is why I have this special adoring bond with Paul. And am grateful for his friendship and miss weekly conversations over the telephone about what we're preaching. Because I did a fair bit of supply preaching in graduate school, too. I have heard that when you're a defense attorney doing a cross-examination, you never ask a question you don't know the answer to. I don't know that that's the best metaphor for when you're a preacher. You maybe can learn something that you don't know the answer to. Sorry, standing somewhere. Okay.
Sometimes the questions I ask.
Yeah. Well, Winston did that yesterday with what's your story or something. I mean, people were kind of doing testimony here. Yeah, I think it may depend on how your congregation, you know, where the trust level is in your congregation. I don't do it because I have such a high need for control in my preaching. I don't want anybody in there. Hey, this is mine. But yeah, it opens it up a little, doesn't it? You know, the question is about what will be on the website. I can put this up on the website, and my Canaanite sister thing is available on my preaching blog. And I can also put a link to that there. I can't give you Lisher's stuff because it's copyrighted. I guess I could ask permission. The Wendell Berry bibliography I can certainly give you and link. And I think I can give you a link to Fred's piece. I'll ask him when I get back to town. So we'll try to get some of that linked up for you. Okay?
Thank you.
Lunch. Yeah, thanks.